Good afternoon. It is a Wednesday, September the 19th, 2018. 12 minutes past the hour, you're tuned into the Now program. Scott Spears along with you for the ride. And we want to thank the Maven of Helpful Hints, Heloise, for appearing in hour number one today. And as you, the listening audience, know, Heloise is with us every third Wednesday of the month from 12:15 to 1 p.m., and she teaches us all about things we need to know, how to fix things, how to make things better, so we thank Heloise quite a bit. Now, a quick programming note, if I can get the words out today. Coming up tomorrow on this program, I know there was a lot in the news last week, and usually we don't deal with things like this, but there was an anonymous letter sent to the New York Times that I'm sure everybody read and saw about on the internet and everywhere else, from somebody allegedly inside the office campaign of President Donald Trump. Well, we want to know who wrote this anonymous letter, and there is only one person who we can go to find out who wrote this anonymous letter, and he will be on tomorrow at 1:15, one of our dear friends, the amazing Kreskin, tomorrow at 1:15. And then at 1:30 tomorrow, we are going to have a guest who I cannot tell you about. We just secured the interview this morning. It's somebody who's never been on this program. It is somebody we have talked about a lot, and it's somebody you're not going to want to miss tomorrow at 1:30. Also, don't forget, coming up next Thursday, September 27th, the last guard out of Alcatraz Prison, Jim Albright, will be right here in Marion giving a seminar on his time at Alcatraz. That will be at the Harding High School here in Marion, Route 309, Harding Highway East, at 7 p.m. next Thursday. Now, Jim Albright will be in studio with us next Thursday from 10 in the morning until 2 in the afternoon. Jim will speak at Harding at 7 p.m. next Thursday, and here's the best part. This event is being put on by the radio station absolutely free of charge. He brings his uniform, he wears it, he shows pictures. The Last Guard out of Alcatraz, next Thursday, 7 p.m. here in Marion, free of charge at the Harding High School Auditorium. Now, this hour, you're not going to want to miss either. He is one of my favorite guests. We're always glad when he stops by, and we can talk about anything going on and also things going on in his life. He's one of the most talented actors. You can catch him right now, by the way, in movie theaters in The Equalizer 2. And I'll tell you something interesting. There's a channel, and I'm sure you can get it on the antenna or cable television, called Antenna TV. Antenna TV reruns the old Johnny Carson Tonight Show every night of the week. And this is one of the things I DVR. They don't rerun the best of. They rerun these episodes in their entirety. And in the last 2 weeks, our guest today has been on about 3 times. So that tells you how often he was on the Johnny Carson Tonight Show, and deservedly so. Johnny loved him, Jack Parr loved him, and I love having him on. Always glad to welcome to these microphones Orson Bean. Orson, how are you?
Better than I deserve.
Orson, I have to tell you, I watch these old Tonight Shows. They hold up well.
It's a strange form of immortality. They'll probably be showing them long after I'm 6 feet under.
Well, hopefully that's not for a while, but you did have a landmark birthday a couple months ago.
I did. I turned 90. I said to my wife, well, I looked in the obit page and I wasn't there. She said, maybe you're not famous enough.
90 years.
Anyway, I'm happy as a clam. I'm sitting here looking out at the California sun and waiting for the big one and just having a blast. Grateful every day I wake up.
Orson, at 90 years old, how do you get to be 90? You're in great shape. You sound great. The mind's working. Everything's good.
Yeah, the body's working, too. I'm going to work tomorrow and doing a guest appearance on a show called The Superstore. And I never watch anything. I haven't seen anything since Gone with the Wind, I think. But my kids all watch it and say it's a funny show, so I'm going to be on that. And I'm shooting a movie in next month in Rhode Island. So, you know, I keep waiting to celebrate my geezerhood by sitting in a rocking chair and rereading Dickens, but it never seems to happen.
Do you have any sort of exercise routine? Have you eaten healthy? Or is it just
no,
luck?
I don't eat healthy. Cheeseburgers is nature's most perfect food as far as I'm concerned. I do 25 push-ups every morning so I can pull myself up out of the sofa as my legs are given away. But that's the only exercise I do. I ride my bicycle all over.
Ah, well, there you go. Now, did your parents live a long time?
Yeah, my grandfather made it to 99. He would have gone longer, but he said, all my friends are dead and the women don't take me seriously anymore. You know, so he just kind of gave up the ghost.
He'd had enough.
It's the luck of the draw. I'm convinced of that. It's the luck of the draw. I don't eat healthy, and I have the odd glass of wine at least once an hour, so it's just the hand you're dealt. I believe that.
You know, interestingly enough, I don't know if people know this or not, but you're married to a very talented actress who people can see on The Bold and the Beautiful. Probably remember her from the Wonder Years, Ally Mills.
Yeah, she was the mom in the Wonder Years, and she's been on The Bold and the Beautiful for 11 years now, going on 12. And I'm on the old and the horny. But she came on 11, 12 years ago to play Betty White's daughter, and Betty White died, the character, in Ally's arms on the beach at Malibu, and the show won the Daytime Emmy for the first time in the 20-odd years it had been on, so they kept Ally, and she's a great fan favorite, and she'll, you know, as long as she wants to. It's a wonderful gig because soap operas are not like regular series, which can go till 2 in the morning. A soap opera is basically banker's hours. It's 9 to 5. You've got to know your lines. You come in, they block and shoot, and you go home at 5 o'clock. So that way she gets to spend a lot of time with her old husband, who keeps young by chasing her around the bedroom.
Well, Orson, I wonder, does having a wife who is a little younger than you, does that play into staying young and vital and healthy?
I'm sure it does. She's 22 years younger than I am, and back when I was courting her, she said, you're too old, you're going to make me fall in love with you, and then you're going to die. I said, well, what are you worried about? The new guy will take you to the funeral. I had an answer for everything, and I wore her down, and she keeps me young. It's true. I love her so much, and she turns me on more now than she did when I married her, was a lot.
I am glad to hear that. Orson, you know, we got a question last time you were on the show. Orson Bean, where did the name, what is your real, is that your real name?
No, I was born with the name Dallas Burroughs. I was named after my grandfather, Dallas Pollard. He, in turn, was named after President Polk's vice president. Who the hell would name their kid after an obscure president's even more obscure vice president? My grandfather's parents did, and mine named me after him, and so I suffered from the name Dallas throughout my childhood. I was breaking into the business working clubs around Boston, and my opening line was, I was doing stand-up comedy and magic. My opening line was, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Dallas Burroughs, Harvard 48, Yale nothing. Well, it didn't get much of a laugh, and so the piano player in the band of this one joint I was working on says, that's because you don't have a funny name, kid. So he made up funny names every night for me to tell the people I was. He said one night, tell me your name is Roger Duck. So I went out, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Roger Duck, Harvard 48, Yale nothing. You could hear crickets in the place. The night he made up the name Orson Bean, pompous first name Orson Welles, silly second name Bean, the whole act played. I got huge laughs. I was excited. I ran back to my dressing room, a nail. But I kept the name because it gotten a laugh.
You know what?
Incidentally, those lines of dialogue are from my one-man show, which I put, I had an offer to take it to New York, and I didn't want to leave the grandkids and the wife and everything. And so I put the show on YouTube, and anybody can see it free. Over 11,000 people have. You just Google Orson Bean one-man show, and you can find it.
Yeah, if you just put in Orson Bean, it's the first thing that comes up. I was watching it a little bit this morning.
Were you?
I was taking a look, and I thought, boy, you know, I know you don't want to leave the grandkids, but boy, people would love to see you all across this country.
Well, anyone can watch it free. I started looking when I was on, when I got cast in Equalizer 2 with Denzel Washington. I played the old white guy. I said, this is typecasting, but I didn't care. But I started looking to see if it was going to do $100 million. Because that's a sign of a bona fide hit, and it has done over $100 million. And then I started to look to see how many people have watched my show, and it's over 11,000. Not $100 million, but still, I brag about it to my wife. She says, Madonna gets a million hits. I said, well, all right.
You know, Orson, I started by talking about Antenna TV, and in the last 2 weeks, I think it's been three times they've replayed episodes of The Tonight Show you were on. What was it like being with Johnny Carson?
I love Johnny. We had a wonderful relationship in the studio. I didn't fraternize with him off. He's a private man, had a small, select group of friends. But we always hit it off in the studio, and you know, in the makeup room before the show, he'd say, "Tell me a joke," you know, or "Come on, I'm going to take a leak, walk through the men's room with me," and so we were great friends at NBC Burbank, which reminds me of the fact that one of the last times I was there, the man I was so proud to call my friend was Bob Hope, who was sitting there in the lobby when I was. Arrived early to go on the Tonight Show. He was over there for something else, and he patted the bench next to me. Sit down, kid. And I sat next to Bob Hope, and this info babe named Kelly Lang, who did the 5 o'clock news, you know, pranced by like a gorgeous pony on her red stilettos. And Hope, then I think probably 87, said, oh, I'd like to get a piece of that.
You know, Bob Hope, from Ohio, originally from the United Kingdom, boy, being a friend, what kind of guy
I
was he?
Bob Hope was born in England. Am I wrong?
No, born in England, but said he was from Ohio. But yeah, he was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was born in England.
Yeah.
What was his, just sitting with him, what was Bob Hope like? We heard a little bit of it there, but what kind of friend was
when
he?
When I was 21 years old, I got my first break and appeared at a famous supper club in New York called the Blue Angel. I was just new in the business, and I'd lucked out and got a great mention in Walter Winchell's gossip column, and started my career going. And a lot of celebrities would come into the club, and one night Bob Hope was there. I was thrilled, of course. He was my childhood idol. And to my absolute delight, he motioned me over to his table, and I sat down next to him, and he praised my act, and we became friends and saw each other on and off over the years, and I just loved him so much. He was so generous to a new kid breaking into the business. And, of course, what he did every Christmas for the troops.
Oh.
Nowadays, in the U2, in the Me Too period, probably he would have been outed because he was a notorious ladies' man, which puts it mildly. And this great man probably would have been destroyed if he were around today. But That's life. What are you going to do?
What are you going to do? We have to go forward. You know, Orson, like I say, obviously you were one of Johnny's favorites. For people who aren't in that business of that time, how big was it to be on the Johnny Carson Tonight Show?
Yeah, you know, for comics, it meant everything. That's what every comic aspired to do, was to be able to do a 6-minute monologue on Carson, and then maybe if God smiled on you, to be called over to the sofa afterwards. I mean, that was heaven. I was on the show over 200 times, 100 of them as a substitute host. Back in the early days, I substitute hosted The Tonight Show over 100 times when it was from New York, before it was such a big deal. That was starting with Jack Parr and then on into Johnny. Mm-hmm. But I remember how many times I was on, because when Johnny retired, NBC published its top 10 most frequent guests, and I always tell people I was number 6, just under, you'll pardon the expression, Charles Nelson Reilly.
You know, this Orson, I think back to The Tonight Show, and you predated Johnny Carson. You were there. Another Ohio native, Jack Parr, hosted The Tonight Show. You were a guest on and guest host on Parr's Tonight Show. What was Parr like?
He was a very private man, an odd man. I didn't know him well. I happened to have been on the night he walked off in high dudgeon because NBC had censored one of his jokes. And I stuck up for Parr and kind of badmouthed NBC, which I learned later is why I got scrubbed from replacing Parr. I had been widely expected to be the next host of The Tonight Show, but because I badmouthed NBC and stuck up for Parr, I lost the job. And incidentally, when Parr came back less than a week later, he invited all his friends to sit in the studio audience and did not invite me. And I wondered why, and it occurred to me, it's like the benevolent plantation owner who gives one of his old slaves, one of his old suits to be buried in. He didn't want somebody doing something for him. He wanted to be the one that did something for you. And it made him uncomfortable, that I think that, I, you know, Freudian-wise, I reasoned this out. It made him uncomfortable that I had stuck up for him. So he didn't invite me that night. Fine with me.
You know, it's very interesting, Orson, that you were there that night, because a gentleman who was a regular guest on this program many, many times, he's still with us, but I believe 97 now, Hugh Downs, I talked to you a lot about that, because he, for people who don't remember, he was Jack Parr's announcer and took over that night when Jack walked off. It was you and Hugh Downs. You said he only knew when he showed up that night. When Jack Parr said there's got to be a better way to make a living and walked off, what'd you think?
Well, the whole country was astonished. I mean, at the time, Hugh Downs was astonished, and he took over the show and began to run it. And it was like after President Reagan was shot, Al Haig said, "Don't worry, I've got the country in hand." Well, he took over and had the show in hand and probably would have run it well. But I was completely stunned. So was Jack Parr. I mean, so was Hugh Downs. And that was the intention of Parr. The show was taped from 5:30 to 7. So, of course, it was on all the network news. And the show, when it aired later that night at 11:30, had the highest ratings that it ever had. Everybody wanted to see this phenomenon. There's an outfit that's doing a documentary about me, of all things, and they got the tape of that night has disappeared, but they got the sound of it, and they use it in the documentary about me. And it's I hadn't realized to the extent that I had badmouthed the network. Small wonder they didn't hire me. I wouldn't have.
Well, it's who else was on that night? Do you remember, Orson?
No, I don't remember at all. I don't remember.
Now,
I saw part of the documentary, and I saw them, but I don't. I only remember stuff that's important, like jokes.
Well, it's interesting because I have it in the notes here, and whoever knows if this is right or not. But Hugh Downs took over when Parr walked off. Now, Parr was gone for about a month, 6 weeks, something like that. Now, didn't you become the guest host for a while?
No, he was actually back a lot quicker than that.
Was
he went to Hong Kong and had a blazer made. He had always admired my blazer. So he had a blazer made by a Hong Kong tailor, and I think he was back within a week. I'm not 100% sure. I don't remember what happened earlier this morning.
So you didn't guest host in that time period?
No, I continued to guest host periodically when he was off, but not in conjunction with that.
Right.
Maybe I didn't. I honestly don't remember, and I don't care.
I'll take that, but it's interesting that NBC was that sensitive about the whole thing.
Oh, they were. Yeah, there was one of the suits in particular. I used to know his name, but that son of a so and so will never host this show. And although I continued to co-host it, I mean to substitute host it, but Johnny Carson, who was doing an afternoon game show or something like that. He took over, and then Johnny and I became friends, and looking back, I'm glad. I don't know what kind of a life I would have had. I wouldn't have had time to have the 9 grandchildren I have, I know that.
What was it like to host The Tonight Show?
Well, I was a nervous wreck the first few times I did it, but I was allowed to pick whoever I wanted as a guest, and so I among the other people I picked and gave her start to was Barbara Streisand. I had seen her. I had wandered into a little club in the village. She was 17 years old, and I said, she blew me away, and I spoke to her afterwards. She knew who I was, and she said, oh, I got a problem. I've had a fight with my mother. I don't have a place to stay. I had a manager at the time named Ted Rosar, and I called him up and said, this kid needs a place to stay. She said, can she crash on the couch in your office? He said, sure. So he said, the key's under the mat. And so Barbara slept there for a couple of nights till she made it up with her mother. But anyway, I told them at the Tonight Show I wanted to have this girl on. They said, are you kidding? She's a kid. Nobody ever heard of her. But I prevailed, and she came on, killed the people, and her career took off.
Absolutely. Certainly did. Who were some of your other favorites, Orson, who you liked to have on?
Oh, I loved Rodney Dangerfield. I mean, that came later, but God, he's so funny. Rodney, you know, had the best jokes, but he could not ad lib, as the saying goes, a burp after a Hungarian dinner. It all had to be scripted, and Johnny knew that. And one night, just for fun, Rodney had done a boffo 10 minutes up there. And he said, Rodney, come over and sit down. And Rodney said, oh, it's okay, Johnny, yelling from center stage. No, come on over. He made him come over and sit down. He says, how you doing, Rodney? It was a long pause, and Rodney said, I got nothing. I said, I'll tell him he could leave. But I remember the last joke I ever remember him saying. He says, I'm so old, I went to Mexico, I got the walks. Didn't get a huge laugh. It was hipper than his usual, takes a little more thought than his usual jokes. Like, I says to my wife, how come you never tell me when you have an orgasm? She says, I'm never near a phone. Ooh, I tell you. Now, my beautiful wife is all dressed up to go to a funeral. Yeah, it's very fine. You're going to draw eyes away from the coffin, though. You look too good. My checkbook is there.
You know,
dead people don't need money. What do you need a check for?
She's
doing something. Allie Mills, ladies and gentlemen, Allie Mills.
Absolutely, on her way to a funeral.
Yeah, that's right. I'm running out of funerals myself.
You really, you've run out of them.
Everybody's so old that I know they're all, almost all dead.
Well, you know, speaking of Betty White, which we were earlier, she was honored, 2 nights ago on the Emmys? That was a nice thing.
Oh, was she? I didn't watch it.
Yeah.
But I love Betty. I'm glad she was honored. And, yeah, Allie loves Betty White, too. But, no, she's probably never going to die.
I doubt it.
I remember watching... Goodbye. Betty White was married to Alan Ludden, who was the host of Password. And they invited me to their house to see the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. What was that, 60 years ago?
Would be.
It was a big deal. The Beatles' first appearance in America was on Ed Sullivan.
There is not television like that anymore.
No, Ed, I was on Ed, you know, 7 or 8 times until I got blacklisted as a communist. But in those days, everybody watched the Ed Sullivan Show. There was only 3 networks. I mean, nowadays when programs are thrilled to get a rating of 13 million people, the average viewership on a Sunday night for Ed Sullivan was 70 million people. I would walk down the street the next morning, "Goodbye, Angel," after having been on Sullivan, and everybody would recognize me. "You were on after the Chinese acrobats." But, those days are gone. It was wonderful.
You know, a lot of Shecky Green, who we had on recently, talked about his experiences on Ed Sullivan. What was it like to be on the Sullivan Show?
What did Shecky say? Did he kind of badmouth him?
Well, he said he liked him later in life, but he said being on the show with him was difficult.
Well, he was a bit of a stiff. He's on our show tonight. We have, anyway. But he was such a sweet guy. I remember we were told, this is back in the 50s, I was the host of a show called The Blue Angel, and we had rather sophisticated people on, and one of the guests was Pearl Bailey, who was a black singing star of great note, and I was told, "Don't touch her. If your shoulder even brushes a black person's shoulder, we will lose stations in the South," and I dutifully obeyed. She went on Ed Sullivan, and he threw his arm around her and said, "How you doing, Paul?" And all over the South, sets went dark. And then the phones and the individual stations all over the South lit up. People said, "What happened to the Ed Sullivan Show?" "Well, he touched a Negro." "Well, I know, but it's the Ed Sullivan Show." And that was the end of that nonsense. Ed had the clout, and he used it.
You know, Orson, when you started out doing comedy, what kind of places were there to play? What were the audiences like?
Oh, I played places like the Moose Club in Haverhill, Massachusetts, and the Veterans of Foreign Wars Hall in Woodstock. I mean, terrible places, you know. There were hecklers in those days. "You stink! Bring out the stripper! Get off!" But the band would laugh at my stuff. The band always said, "Your stuff is too hip for the room, kid." Mm. So it kept my spirits up. And I had my magic tricks to get off with, so I got enough of a hand that I get booked back. But then when I finally got a gig in a sophisticated club in New York and got laughs for the first time, I was thrilled. But by and large, the clubs, there was an awful lot of work in those days. TV had just been invented. And very few people had television sets, so people still went out in those days. And there were big business in clubs like Fry, Sat, Sun, Three Big Acts, Three, direct from Boston. And I worked in, places like in, all over New England. There was a full year's work, split weeks and full weeks. And then I moved to Philadelphia. It was a full week, year's work booked out of Philly. And I used it to hone my act and write new material. And so by the time I arrived in New York and got an opening at the Blue Angel, I was ready. So you need places to be bad in. That's true of actors, too. There used to be a lot of summer stock work where young kids would do a whole season playing different parts. And the guy playing the juvenile lead still has white powder behind his ears from when he played the colonel last week.
You know, there is no training ground anymore, and it shows.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it shows.
There isn't, and so people, take acting class and do scenes with. I worked with the great acting teacher, Wynn Hanman, who is still at the age of 96, is still teaching actors how to act. He's wonderful. But it's hard now because there aren't places to be bad in.
What is the secret to acting?
The secret is, it's a noun, occasionally used as a verb. I don't know what the secret is. What?
Well, you know, Orson, when you're...
The secret is, if a young person comes to me and says, I want to be an actor, but my parents say I should also get a college degree so I'll have a backup, I always say, your parents are right, because they ain't going to make it. If a kid comes in, I want to be an actor, and I'm determined to do it, and I'm not going to college, I'm going to... And then I say, you got a shot, kid. Go ahead. Just believe in yourself. And just do it. Take every job. Get one of those newspapers like Backstage West that tells where there are open auditions. Show up for the audition. Show up and audition with something you know you're not going to get. It's an opportunity to act for 3 minutes. And if you do that, there's a good chance, if you have any talent at all, you'll find a niche in the business.
When did you realize this is what you wanted to do? You wanted to be on stage.
I wanted to be a magician when I was 6 years old, and I never wavered until I decided the magic tricks weren't very good, and I was the patter that I was using was more important. I became a stand-up comic, and then I became an actor. I never wanted to do anything else. Of course, I did wait on table and pull sodas behind the drugstore soda fountain, you know, to make a living. But basically, you know, I never wavered. I always wanted to be in the business. It never occurred to me that I wouldn't be a success. Maybe not a huge star, but a success. And because it never occurred to me not to, I did it. Like the bumblebee who does not know he can't fly, so he goes ahead and flies anyway.
Mm. You know, Orson, I always hear about stage presence. How long did it take you to become comfortable performing in front of people?
Well, but, I mean, when I first got paid, it was $3 doing my magic act at the Friday night Methodist church dinner. And I felt okay about being up in front of the... I had done it ever since kindergarten. I was the class clown, always trying to draw attention to myself. So I wanted the attention. I wasn't getting any at home, so I wanted to get it in class, in school, so I became the class clown. So I was used to being looked at, and I liked it. I still do.
Mm.
I enjoy meeting people. Fans come up and say, oh, I'm sorry to bother you. I said, do I look bothered? I love talking to people who have seen me on TV. It's a way to just speak to a lot of interesting people you otherwise wouldn't get to talk to. I don't feel arrogant or anything like that. I'm humble that people want to talk to me. My wife and I go to an all-black church. We're the only white people in it, and it's the most wonderful preacher and the most wonderful congregation that talks back to the preacher. That's right. Oh, yeah, that's right. Don't tell him. Yeah, that's right. Jesus would say that. Yeah, yeah. So when it was announced we were going to join the church, there was a round of applause, and an old guy yelled, there goes the neighborhood. But I'm always grateful that they've accepted me as a white person, and I feel humble and grateful every time I set foot in the church every Sunday.
When somebody comes up to you, Orson, what is usually the frame of reference? What do they remember you from?
Lately, it's reruns of Two and a Half Men. You were on. You beat Charlie Sheen with a cane. Yeah, it didn't do him any good, did it? But that episode of Two and a Half Men, where I'm this rich guy who shows up because Charlie is doing my trophy wife, is seen by more people. So in recent years, it's that episode. Even though I did 7 years on Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman, and I did the last 3 years of Desperate Housewives and the various movies and things I made, that's what people remember me for most recently. Otherwise, in the long periods, probably To Tell the Truth, which I did for 7 years, sitting between the elegant Kitty Carlisle and the raspy voice Peggy Cass. I used to call her the ward healer's daughter.
You know, Kitty Carlisle was on this program before she passed away. I think she lived to be 97 or something.
Not like. After?
Not, well, we tried to book her, but she was busy.
All right.
Yeah. What was Kitty Carlisle like?
Love Kitty. Yeah. She was a true lady and a wonderful woman. We maintained a friendship to the very end. When I would go to New York, she would have me up for lunch in her Park Avenue duplex, which she had shared with her longtime husband, Moss Hart, the director of My Fair Lady and Camelot. She married well, as he used to remind her on her on that 25th anniversary. She told me this one time during a commercial break, on To Tell the Truth, that the butler tiptoed out of the dining room, leaving Moss and Kitty sitting alone at a table that otherwise could have sat 16, and he put his hand on hers and says, "Well, Kitty, you've stuck with me through thick."
You know, Moss Hart, his book, Act One, which I believe is the it's an interesting book because it gives an interesting insight into actors and basically says that all actors are shy people, and this is their outlet. Did you find that with yourself?
All actors are what people?
Shy. Timid.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or fine. I could, it's a bad connection.
Yeah.
What kind of people are all actors?
Timid. Timid people.
Oh, timid?
Yes.
I don't know. Probably true. I know that most comics are not happy people. I know that. I'm the exception of the rule. I consider myself a happy person, but I've had to work very hard at becoming happy. I remind myself every day when I wake up that I'm really happy. I have to remind myself of it. And once I do, I realize it's true. Happy and grateful. I think gratitude and reminding yourself to feel grateful as many times a day as you can is one key to happiness. About actors, I don't know. I suppose, I mean, anything where you want to get up in front of people means that you're insecure, probably, you want acceptance, so probably they're timid. I don't know.
It was an interesting book, that's for sure. The talk shows, or the game shows, excuse me. When you were on the game shows, did Match Game and a lot of those game shows, did you try to help the people win? Was it a... How did that...
Well, it depended on the people. Like, when I was in Tell the Truth, there was an unspoken thing among the panelists. If there was a kid on there, we were sure that the kid got some votes. Always. I myself came to an understanding about who the right person was on To Tell the Truth. Three people have climbed the Matterhorn. I'm so-and-so, and I climbed the Matterhorn. I'm so-and-so, and I climbed... So I, early on, could tell immediately who was the real one, because he was the one that told you the least. He didn't want you to know he was the real one, so he told you very little. The other two had worked very hard to learn all there was to learn about mountain climbing and the Matterhorn, and they were anxious to share the information. So when Kitty Carlisle or Peggy Cass or Tom Poston would say, "I voted for number two because he knew that the Matterhorn is so many feet high," that's why I didn't vote for number two. So I always knew, almost always, which was the real one. But I didn't care about that. I just cared about getting some laughs and having fun. So I didn't put my knowledge that I'd figured out to any useful purpose. But, I mean, think back in those days. The three panelists shared a pot of $500. You know, talk about small money.
Mm. Yeah,
but I guess everybody loves to be on TV,
I guess that's right. You know, Match Game was one that I always found interesting, and they've brought it back, and it's more salacious than it was then, but it was salacious back then. Were you in...
Yeah, we helped coarsen the culture by saying things like pee-pee and doo-doo and kitty stuff. We learned you could say pretty dirty stuff if you used the kitty version of it. I'm not proud of it, but we did. And it was you know, quite graphic. And Gene Rayburn was very funny. There's a thing they show on TV where I'm standing by off stage because one of the panelists, I can't think of his name, he was on MASH, he's going to have a baby any minute, and he might have to run out. So Gene Rayburn brought me out and said, "It was so good of you, Orson, to stand by in case he has to leave because his wife was having the baby." And I said to him, Well, I felt it was my obligation to do so, inasmuch as I had performed the same function at the conception. And, of course, it was only on match game you could get away with stuff like that.
Well, you know, that's interesting, because when I see stand-up comedians perform today, even on television, they have to bleep so much of their material because the language is not allowable on broadcast television. But now the bleep is just there.
Well, they're all working dirty because of political correctness. How can you be funny if you can't insult people? Even in a gentle way, you can't make fun of women. You can't make fun of any ethnic group. You can't make fun of black people. You can't make fun of the Irish. You can't make fun of Muslims, certainly. You can't make fun of anybody, so you start working dirty, because that's all that's left. Smut is what's left, or as they used to call it, cack. I mean, where would Gallagher and Sheen have been in the days of vaudeville if you couldn't do, you know, anti-Catholic jokes or, you know, anti-black jokes or anti-women? My wife is so stupid, you know, stupid blonde. You can't do stupid blonde jokes anymore. You can't do anything. There's a joke. There's a ventriloquist is working in a nightclub, and he's doing Polish jokes. And the dummy says, the Polacks are so stupid that this, and a guy in the nightclub raises his hand and says, excuse me, and the ventriloquist stops and says, what? He says, I am of Polish origin, and I want you to know I find these jokes deeply offensive. And the ventriloquist says, I'm really sorry. And the guy says, I'm not talking to you. Well, you can't tell that joke anymore.
Well, that's right.
Maybe we'll see if you guys just bleep that. Make fun of Polish people. You can't make fun of anybody anymore because this is the age of not hurting anyone's feelings. So, and that's why all the comics are talking dirty. And if they get bleeped, they get bleeped. Everybody knows that it was the F word.
Well, what is the ultimate end, do you think? Comedy, I think, will be around, but does it just keep getting more risque and risque?
Probably. I mean, hopefully the country will be saved from political correctness, but I don't know that it's going to happen anytime soon. And in this era of political correctness, you know, I think it's harder and harder to be funny.
Well, you know, a song.
Luckily, I don't have to be.
Well, a song, and I've always wondered, but you've done it for us a couple of times, the Baloney song. Where did that come from? Where did that?
I mean, that could be perceived as anti-Semitic or anti-Irish or anti, you know, whatever you want to say. And so they would never let me do that on The Tonight Show today. I've did it in the past, but times, as they say, have changed.
Where did you find that song? Where did it come from?
Where does what come from?
The song. How did you come to do
it? Oh, it's an old vaudeville song. When I knew it when I was a young kid. I've never claimed to have written it. It was around, but nobody else ever did it. So I just started doing it. Made it my own. That and my signature paper tree, which I did many times on Ed Sullivan and The Tonight Show. I learned that from a magician at a kid's birthday party. I dumbed him until he taught me how to do it, to get rid of me. Okay, kid, here's how you do it. So it was something that had been around, and I just adapted it. Nobody writes a joke. No one knows where a joke, per se. People write funny lines. People write routines. But a joke, per se, I don't know that anyone has ever taken credit for. And I love jokes. The joke is a much maligned art form, considered to be at the bottom of the literary barrel. But a joke told properly in the present tense and concisely can be nothing short of elegant. So, but nobody tells jokes anymore. It's considered old-fashioned.
Mm. You know, Orson, a lot of people don't realize this. World War II, what was your participation in that?
Oh, my participation in World War II was listening to Edward R. Murrow on the radio from a rooftop in London saying, the buzz bombs are landing in London. The minute the war was over, I joined the army and spent a year in Japan on occupation duty. And I was not only patriotic, but I wanted to take the deal that was being offered, which is you could get your selective service out of the way in 18 months in those days. And I did so, and friends of mine who said, what are you joining for, kid? There's never going to be a draft again. Many of those cynics spent long, miserable years in Korea. But I spent a year in Japan and got it out of the way, and I'm, to this day, a vet. Thank you very much. Stand up and salute me.
Absolutely. You know, Orson, the baloney song, we can do it here on radio. We've done it before. Can you give us some of that?
Oh, look, it's long. You don't want to hear that. People can Google Orson Bean baloney song.
They
can
hear
it. But Google my one-man show, people. Orson Bean one-man show. Live performance, and it's an hour and a half long, and you'll love it.
We got 3 minutes left here, Orson, before we wrap up today. When you look back at the career, what was your favorite time period?
Oh, the 50s.
50s?
The 50s were wonderful, career or not. I just come to New York, and the people make fun of the 50s, but I thought the 50s were wonderful. In those days, you could walk around Manhattan, and on a hot summer night, you could fall asleep in Central Park with your arm around your girlfriend and go to sleep and wake up in the morning and go for breakfast. There was no street crime that certainly was being reported. The subways were a nickel, and if you missed one, another one came along in a few minutes. I thought life in New York in the 50s was wonderful. I don't know how it was in Shreveport or any of the other parts of the country, but I suppose it was great there, too.
Do you ever foresee a time when you would want to retire?
Sure, I'd like to sit in a rocking chair right now and read Dickens, but instead I'm going to do a movie next month in Rhode Island. I'm starting tomorrow to do a guest appearance on another show. There's always parts for geezers, so they keep asking for my services, and I don't have the moral character to say no.
Do you like the roles today? When they send you the script, do you say, I like this?
Well, I'm going to do a part in this movie in Rhode Island. It's a little indie. Probably nothing will ever come of it, but maybe it will. And the guy is the antithesis of everything I believe in. He's a greedy, mean guy who pays the heroine $100 to break his ankle so he can fraudulently collect insurance money and join the country club. Now, I always say I can play anything. I think I could play Juliet, a 15-year-old girl. Nobody would hire me, probably, but I could play it.
Is it?
So I kind of took this to see if I could play a guy that I normally would walk out of the room if he was around.
Are villains more fun to play?
Oh, always. Always. Given equal actors, Iago steals the show from Othello. Yeah, the negative is always more interesting to people because secretly they all want to do bad stuff and they don't dare to. So if they see a character portrayed doing the bad stuff that they secretly would like to do, they love them. I mean, yes, Iago steals the show from Othello. Donald Duck steals the show from Mickey Mouse. The negative always wins out.
Orson, final question here. Obviously, you're in these movies, Two and a Half Men, sitcoms. They're still replaying the Johnny Carson shows from 40 years ago. When you're gone and people look back on those and they look you up, what do you hope they remember about your time here in the entertainment industry?
Oh, I hope they have spoken to all the women I've bedded. Joking. I'm one of the few guys that can look back and not worry about the Me Too wackos, because I don't think I've ever inappropriately done anything with a woman. Instead, I've married a beautiful one, and I'm happy as a clam. I married another beautiful one before, and she comes around all the time, almost too much. But the women have befriended each other. I see them laughing together and looking over at me, and I think, what's their secret? A common enemy?
Well, Orson, you are always welcome to come on this show. We love having you on. And keep making those movies, keep making those appearances, because we love seeing you.
Bless your heart. Good talking to you.
Thank you, Orson. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Orson Bean, legendary guest on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Jack Parr, he's in The Equalizer 2, Two and a Half Men, Will and Grace. you'll find Orson Bean. Coming up tomorrow on the show, the amazing Kreskin is going to analyze the letter that was sent to the New York Times, and we have a guest on tomorrow afternoon who we've talked about a whole lot, who I'm not going to tell you about until tomorrow. But for today, that's it. This is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
Good night tonight and a better day tomorrow. Above all, have happy trails.
It's the place to be for your friends and your family. Our place is WWGH 107.1 FM.
One of our great people, the 40th Treasurer of the United States, Mary Ellen Withrow. Mary Ellen, so glad to see you.
Well, I'm glad to see you, Scott. I'm always amazed at all of these celebrities that you get. You're going through quite a bunch there. You're my favorite interviewer.
And that's all the time we have for today. We will be back tomorrow. Don't miss it, starting at 10:15 in the morning. Okay. This is Scott Spears for this day, heading for the dugout.
The place, WGH 107.1 FM.
Programming on WWGH Radio 107.1 FM is supported by CRT Mechanicals. Address, 2842 Marion Waldo Road. Telephone number, 740